It's all too easy to get caught up in the moral panic over youngsters' addiction to social media and digital devices. But this week, we speak to the founder of a children's magazine publisher proving the kids are all right. And as Poland gets its own edition of Vogue, we pick the brains of its editor-in-chief, plus the print rebirth of an English-language title based out of Japan. All that ahead today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Now, if your idea of a kids' magazine is a garish compilation of maze puzzles with plenty of free tat stuck to the front cover, you're clearly unfamiliar with Anorak. Founded in 2006, it's a quarterly magazine aimed at 6 to 12-year-olds, both boys and girls, designed to be as collectible as mum and dad's favourite subscriptions. And it's clearly doing something right, with circulations over 20,000, and its under fives offshoot Dot is a similar story, with more than 10,000 subscribers. Its editor, Kathy Olmedias, comes from a somewhat, maybe incongruous print background, given that, having worked on 90s lifestyle titles The Face and Sleaze Nation, and she joins me now, I'm very happy to say. Kathy, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you with us. Now, these are things of beauty, and it is interesting. I wonder, as a starting point, let's roll the clock on back to 2006. Did you just say, look, kids need to have something that's beautiful and collectible and well-designed, and it shouldn't just be garish, shouty, plastic nonsense, yeah, which I know from personal experience is what kids generally both are sold and drawn
yeah
to.
Yeah.
Was that the driver?
That was one of the main drivers. I had become a mum, you know, 4 years prior to that. And obviously during my 20s, I had been working in magazines. So I had the kind of the magazine itch within me. I wanted to launch my own. I became a mum in 2002. And in my 20s, I had worked in magazines like The Face and Sleaze Nation. So I always had a kind of love for magazine, a passion for magazines, really. Mm. And when I became a mum, I kind of discovered that, you know, the magazine market had become quite polarized and very odd. Everything seemed to be kind of attached to a cartoon character or some kind of brand. It was an extension of something. They didn't seem to be like the magazines that I used to read when I was a child. So I thought, I'll launch one and see what happens. You know, obviously I had a little bit of experience, a little bit of contacts in the distribution world, although the door closed very quickly when I announced what I was doing, which obviously didn't fit in the kind of, you know, in the sort of standards.
That's funny though, isn't it? Because I would have thought that would really pique people's interest. And there'd be so many other of your contemporaries who'd say, oh my God, about time, you know.
But so parents and contemporaries and illustrators, we had a lot of support there. However, on the distribution front, thankfully Borders was there and I knew them from previous experience and they put a decent order through, but distributors were really reluctant. In fact, we couldn't get any distribution until we got Borders on board. There was all sorts of things. The fact that it was quarterly, the frequency was a problem for them. The fact that it didn't have any plastic toys on the front cover was a problem. The fact that it was unisex was a problem, which it didn't even occur to me that would be a problem, but it was apparently. And also they had a problem kind of fitting it into different shelves. So they weren't sure whether it should be within the parenting section or within the kids section. Too beautiful to be in the kids section and kind of not really for parents. So it was 2006 was, you know, a bit of a struggle in education.
It's funny. It's almost as if, our illustrious colleagues on the distribution side are maybe not as enlightened as they might be. Heaven forbid we'd ever mention that on the stack. But it's interesting, isn't it? What are we now? 12 years
yes,
on.
Yes.
It's extraordinary. And obviously so many additions. What's been the biggest change? Has it been that sort of attitudinal shift when you explain to maybe people who aren't familiar with it what it is and why it is? Or is it just, I don't know, is it easier now? It probably is. Or I don't know, does it ever get easy?
Yeah, I think it's definitely easier. I think one of the things when I realised that distribution was going to be so difficult, the internet was just being born more or less then. So I decided to kind of use that. Social media's channels were just, you know, being born as well. So I decided to use that to sort of help promote the magazine and educate parents that there were other things on the market than just, you know, the plastic toys and the plastic tap that was on the mainstream shelves. And 12 years on, you know, we don't have to educate, thankfully, people anymore. It's just a matter of them being aware of what we do. But generally speaking, there's a great awareness out there of what we do. And we've kind of created this little niche that's turned into a little small avenue, but it's still, you know, so we kind of sit in between the very, very independent titles and also the kind of more mainstream titles.
Well, yeah, let me ask you a bit about, so there's obviously Dot as well, which is for the sort of, I guess what we'd say in this country, preschool.
Schooling.
I guess that's
the same
everywhere.
Yeah.
Again, it sort of makes sense, and that's been around for a short time, but you're now branching that out into the Spanish language as well, imminently, which is very exciting. What was the origin story of that? Again, was it just this feeling that, hey, we're quite good at doing this. And what about the under fives?
So Anorak was very much a personal journey, if you like, a personal odyssey almost, because I'd become a mum and that's the kind of magazine I wanted to read with my son. And I realised there were parents around me that needed the same. Dot was very much led by public demand, if I may say so. I used to receive a lot of emails. I mean, a huge amount of emails, people asking me to do a younger version of Anorak, because often young parents wanted something for their market for very young children. It's even more plastic tack and even more pink or blue. So it was very much public demand. I thought, okay, well, 3 years ago, I thought, well, let's give it a try and see what happens. And it's done really, really well, so well that, you know, we're now launching a Spanish edition on the 5th of March.
Wonderful stuff. Well, yeah, my son would love a day in the life of
a monkey,
which I know you wrote, I can see from that, which is brilliant. But tell me a bit about some of the mechanics here, because I know that also within the, is it sort of Anorak Studio, you're also doing other projects which are sort of more commercial in character. And that's something that's kind of crept up over the, you know, last couple of years. At what point, was that just something that you thought, I don't know whether you were approached, or did you say, hey, look, there's something we can also capitalise on, this good position we've got, that early adopter advantage. At what point did that enter your thinking, and what kind of a role does that play basically in the sort of viability of the whole business? Is that one of the key drivers?
So Studio Anorak was born. We've always been asking the last kind of 5 to 6 years to do some stuff for other brands. So it would be maps, you know, it might be colouring walls, it might be posters and things like this. 2 or 3 years ago, I thought maybe we can turn this to something a little bit bigger and just give it a fancy title like Studio Anorak. And then 2 years ago, we were approached by the city of Hull, which was the city of culture in 2017. And most of the team were parents there, and they all subscribed to Anorak and Dot. And they thought it would be a great idea for all the primary school children of Hull to have a quarterly magazine that would celebrate the heritage of the city and the history of the city. So we created these 4 magazines for them. At the same time, by some serendipity, Airbnb got in touch and wanted also us to produce a magazine for an event they're doing with the Natural History Museum called Dinosnores. So Explore magazine was born. And then we also did, the Scouts Association got in touch and wanted us to create an activity book for their leaders and also the children, the little scouts and beavers that go there.
You sort of said almost, you know, serendipitously, and you have this thing where you think, actually, I don't see that there's what I want, so I can start to do it. And then you kind of corner the market. And I guess it's that truism that if you stick with what you're passionate about and what you understand, actually the people do come. You don't need some crazy, grand, complex business plan. People are drawn to something that fills a niche that maybe they didn't even know was there, but it was definitely there.
You've put it in much better words than I could ever put it. But absolutely, and that's what's always been at the core of Anorak, I think, is authenticity. It comes from a very authentic place. You know, it's a mum, me, wanting a better magazine to read with my child, and it's kind of runs through everything that we do. And I think with a little bit of patience, the audience just find you and then become your best ambassadors. A lot of the people who work with us, a lot of our clients from Studio Anorak are actually subscribers, and they come to us because they love the magazine, and they're waiting for that project where we can come on board and help them. So it's been hugely organic. It's been absolutely, you know, amazing, and I'm very grateful that it's happened that way. The first kind of 5 years of the life of Anorak was very much a project. I did this kind of on the side, and then 5 years into it, I decided to turn it into a business, not knowing at all what a business plan was a strategy.
Never
was.
Let those details
None
get
of those
in the
things,
way,
you know.
Kathy,
but actually, it's been incredible because I have been managed to bumble along but actually create a sizable business with a great loyal audience. So I feel very, very grateful. I think there is a next stage to that, and the next stage, the business plan has to come into place.
Eventually, you have to do it. We'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. But I want to pick up actually on a theme which we've mentioned in sort of tangentially by talking about Dot going into Spanish language. And that's this question of, I guess, branching out titles internationally and whether they're relatively newer, as the Anorak and Dot are, or seasoned international titles that many tens of thousands of people know, like Vogue. What are some of the challenges? And we'll listen, and Kathy, if you stay with us, we can listen to a little piece here. Because last week, Condé Nast and Polish media venture Wisteria launched Vogue Polska, the 23rd international edition of the title, and it landed with a splash. Its rough and ready cover has two models posing in front of a black Volga car, if my untrained eye is right, with the imposing Soviet-era Palace of Culture and Science looming in the background. Interesting. At its helm is editor-in-chief Philip Niedenthal, and he spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco about the experience.
It's been a long time coming. I can remember when I started working in about 2000, people were already talking about Vogue Poland then, because Vogue Russia had just launched. People have been waiting for this for a long time, and the market has, you know, caught up. And I think, yeah, for the past 2 or 3 years, we really have been ready.
And tell us a bit more about the business side of it, Philip. It's kind of a partnership between, of course, Condé Nast and Polish company Wisteria, right?
Yeah.
How does it compare to other Vogues in the world, for example?
It's a franchise, so it's governed by its own rules. We report to Condé Nast International in London, and we work very closely with Karina Dobrotowskaya and Fiona Hayes at Condé Nast. All the content is ours. We come up with it, we commission it, we produce it. And we consult it with CNI. What we're aiming for is to make it as Polish as possible, because it's very important for us and for our readers to, you know, to get a sense that this is actually for the Polish reader, with them in mind.
And Filipe, we have to describe here to the listeners the first cover, which is, you know, a beautiful shot by Jürgen Teller with Polish
yes.
models Ania Rubik and Malgosia Bella. It's beautiful and it's, may I say, it's very different from the other Vogues I've seen. Would you mind describing it for us?
We've always wanted, both Kasia Kulczyk, the founder of Wisteria, Malgosia Bella, who was our editor at large, and myself, we always knew we wanted to work with Jürgen Teller. And we knew that if we wanted Jürgen to be involved, we would have to make this a very special project. We also wanted, like I said, to make it immediately recognizable to the Polish reader as something Polish, shot in Poland for the Polish reader. The most Polish thing I could think of, it's a very divisive building. It's the Palace of Culture and Science in the center of Warsaw, which was actually a gift from Stalin in 1955 to the Polish people. For my parents' generation, people in their 60s, 70s, it's still a symbol of communism. For someone like myself, I've grown up with it, and for me, it is, for better or worse, the symbol of Warsaw, as it is for my friend Margosha and our contemporaries. It's a very recognizable landmark in Warsaw, and it's recognizable to everyone all over Poland as something Polish. Well, we shot in November for the March issue. It's a bit bleak outside, it's, as you can see in the picture. You can actually see it's just started to snow, but we wanted to keep it that way because this is Poland, and in March in Poland, it does still tend to snow. We made the decision to leave it as clean as possible, to make it as graphic as possible, just to have the tower and Margosha and Ania and the Black Volga, which is another relic of our past here in Poland. It's not a Polish car, but it's very symbolic for Poles here. And altogether, it makes for a very graphic, striking image.
And Philip, may I ask, you know, of course you were mentioning about the divisive building as well. At the same time that Poland, you know, is growing, the luxury market is doing very well. Of course, you know, there's some controversies about in the political side with the conservatism of Law and Justice. Do you think the magazine will touch in perhaps some political aspects of Polish society as well?
Well, I think, these days it's impossible not to be political, and anything that you say or do or produce or show has a political aspect to it. We're Vogue, we're not overtly political, but on the other hand, we are for Polish women, first and foremost, and our interest is their interest. Their interests are our interests, and we have to have their backs. So we are on the side of Polish women.
Great. And another thing that I love, because here at the Stack, we, you know, we value print a lot. And I saw that your initial print run is 160,000 copies. That's very confident. I like it.
Like I said, we both myself and everyone involved, we know that the market has been waiting for this for a long time. People are very excited. It's a milestone in Polish media, and perhaps not just media. We are very confident, and it's the first issue. It's a very strong issue. It's proven to be a controversial issue. So I think, you know, that risk we took, well, you can see it paying off right now. It's I keep getting text messages and emails all day from friends and acquaintances saying they can't find the magazine anywhere because it's sold out in all the kiosks and all the other points of sale. So we're very pleased.
That was Filip Niedenthal there speaking to Fernando. The inaugural issue of Vogue Polska is available now. And I guess, Kathy, preparing Dot to go into the Spanish language, your preoccupations and considerations are probably a little bit different than the latest Vogue offshoot. But nevertheless, there's certain things there which are interesting. I guess one for Vogue, one of their critical questions will be that, you know, for their Polish readers, potential Polish readers, they'll already be familiar with Vogue in a number of its international iterations. So I guess you've got to balance out what you're delivering for them with their existing expectations and familiarities. And I wonder with Dot, on a sort of tangential point, how deeply do you know that market? You're obviously a Spanish speaker, and one would imagine that the preoccupations of the under fives are broadly similar. But how do you go about establishing whether the same formula works in both?
I think because the magazine is mostly illustrated, illustration tends to be a very universal language. So I think we don't have the same kind of differences in standards that I guess you would have to apply with a photographic magazine like Vogue. Basically, we got a very good distributor out there, and they kept asking us whether we should try to launch a Spanish-speaking edition. Originally, they wanted Anorak, but Anorak is very difficult to translate because a lot of it is hand-drawn. Mm. It's very crafted, and it's aimed at a slightly older audience. I think Dot, being younger, is much more universal in terms of what parents want for their children, but also because it's very highly illustrated. As I said, illustration being more of a universal language, I think it might work very well. You know, with those things at the end, you can do all the market research you want. We get great feedback from our readers. You can do all sorts of market research, but at the end, you just have to go with it, which is what I've always done with any magazines that I've launched. And I just thought, let's give it a try and see what happens. And I think, you know, so far, we've announced it on our social media networks and we've had a great response.
So get along and check it out.
Yeah.
Spanish. Well, Churro the Round Bunny, he should be fine. Or
yes,
she.
Yes, because he doesn't say anything.
I mean, he's called Churro, right? So my language limitations at least suggest that he's broadly in the right place.
Yeah.
So tell me about how you... I mean, you wouldn't do like a focus group. Well, good luck if you try.
No way.
With an under five. So is it all very kind of anecdotal, the way you build
instinctive,
you know, your priorities? Yeah.
Yeah, instinctive. Everything that I've always done has always been instinctive. And I've learned some terrible lessons through it and I've learned some amazing lessons, you know. But generally speaking, I feel quite blessed and my instincts have been right on most instances. And with Dot, yeah, it was absolutely 100% instinctive. I've never done any focus group. Of course, we get lots of emails from our readers, which some are taken into account, others I don't. And we get a lot of letters from readers as well, lovely letters from our little readers and our little editors.
I have to ask you about that because I find it so endearing. And there's obviously some pictures and things that people submit in.
Yes.
I just would be constantly pouring over my inbox, moved probably to tears with the sweetness and the endearing messages. I mean, it must just be to get a really heartfelt email, or I imagine what handwritten letters and things must be absolutely brilliant.
Yes, it's absolutely the best about the job, really. Commissioning illustrators as well is an absolute joy, but receiving letters and love letters and happy letters from our readers is just incredible. The next issue, the theme is kindness. So you would have been in bits to read some of the letters.
I need to mentally prepare myself for that.
Yes.
This is surely a series of short books that you need to publish as well.
It would be great.
Correspondence from your readers. And
from
that's,
our readers.
That'd be brilliant. Lovely Christmas time, you know,
stockings. Yes, yes. Anorak, when we first launched it, a lot of people thought it was very highbrow because of the way it looked. And I always wanted it to be as inclusive as possible. Mm. I mean, as very, very inclusive. And which is why I invited lots of little editors, and we call them little editors, which is why I invited those children to participate in the magazine. And the inspiration for them to see their drawings next to, you know, a grown-up and professional illustrator is absolutely amazing. We get letters from teachers to thank us. We get letters from parents to thank us, and also from themselves to say, you know, that's inspired me. Some of our little editors, believe it or not, have actually worked for us. So they're now 18, you know, 18, 19, and they are illustrators themselves.
Because we've been going for,
that makes me feel like a dinosaur, but it's a great feeling to know that, you know, they've been a little bit inspired by what we're doing.
Very much so, very much so. Right, well, let's go off on a bit more of a tangent for another little piece. It's interesting, we're talking about different languages and how things work or are lost in translation, and that's a bit of a theme we'll pick up on again here with the Kyoto Journal. I've got a copy there. You can have a quick browse of that, Kathy, mm-hmm. if you want. It's an English language magazine seeking to offer genuine insights into Japan and Asia. First published 30 years ago, if you'll believe it, it switched to a digital-only model in 2010. More's the pity. But now, I guess 30 years in, why not celebrate by returning to the print edition? To find out more, Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan spoke to the title's managing director, Lucinda Cowing.
So Kyoto Journal, it's a magazine that's been around since 1987, and it covers Asia from the viewpoint of Kyoto. Our team is based in Kyoto, and we take inspiration from it and the cultural values it embodies. It's not a place that you sort of seek fame and fortune in necessarily. It's more a place that where you pursue mastery, beauty, and knowledge. Taking inspiration from this extraordinary place, we've come to cover all manner of topics throughout Asia.
And tell me a little bit about the history of Kyoto and its role within Japanese culture.
So it's a very special place. It wasn't firebombed during the war, so it sort of remains a sort of time capsule within Japan. It was the seat of the emperor for 1,100 years. And there's a great deal of pride around that. Even sort of 100 years after the emperor's left, you still have many businesses that boast connections to the imperial house.
So let's talk a little bit about the magazine itself. I've got the latest issue, is that right, in front of me?
That's right.
It's celebrating 30 years of the magazine, so it's had a decent run so far. Tell me a little bit about what's in this issue. Maybe you can talk me through two or three features that you feel really illustrate the ethos of the journal.
So Kyoto Journal was in print between 1987 and 2010. We had the support of a rather unusual individual, Shohei Harada, and he was the son of a wealthy calligrapher and entrepreneur. And Shohei himself was supporting projects all across Asia, not just Kyoto Journal. But unfortunately, he passed away and we were forced into a position where we could no longer print. Our team is entirely volunteer. It's always been really a labour of love. Everyone else has sort of full-time jobs. After 7 years as a digital edition, we decided to resurrect the print edition, which was really the medium we thought it ought to be in. Indeed, after releasing digital issues, we'd always have requests for a print version of them, which we could not do. It was a big shock for the volunteers in 2010, especially from the point of view that we were running on a shoestring budget. But we had enough sort of left to sort of put together a website and therefore a platform from which to sell digital issues. And selling in digital, you know, there are certain advantages to it. We always find that we have far too much content each issue. We could easily print, you know, 200-page long issues with the number of submissions we get every day. From the point of view of the actual reading experience, that's just not what people wanted in the end. And so we sort of thought, well, why don't we try and resurrect the print edition somehow? And in 2017, rather, the circumstances where it just so happened that we received a surprise donation. We managed to strike a deal with a local printer that really believed in what we do and sort of bent over backwards to accommodate us, really.
I'm interested. You mentioned that the magazine is volunteer-driven, and you also say that you receive so many submissions, way more than you need. Who's contributing? Who generally writes for you? What kind of person are they?
Actually, it's quite interesting with volunteerism. It does tend to bring out the best in people, and I think that goes for writers too. When we do receive submissions, they come from the heart. In terms of how we've put the magazine together, we rarely put out a call for submissions. We just organically collect content that we've received and look at it and figure out, oh, well, how can we tie these together?
And do you want to talk me through just two or three articles in the current issue, just to give us a flavour of the kind of typical content that you carry?
As I say, although we cover all of Asia, not just Kyoto, but this was sort of a celebration of Kyoto, and it felt fitting for our 30th year and being our first print edition in 7 years. It's got a special section. It's called Craft Ecologies, and it refers to the very intricate network of artisans in Kyoto and some outside of Kyoto, and how they sort of coexist with each other and are supported by businesses. And we've tied them together quite nicely. So, for example, we have a maker of, well, they process silk cocoons into strings for musical instruments exclusively. This workshop in Shiga Prefecture, which is actually just neighbouring to Kyoto. And we tied this interview together with a shamisen repairer. A shamisen is a free-stringed Japanese banjo, if you like. There are a number of ways that we're sort of planning to take the journal forward. The magazine would be just one element, of course, the main one. But we've been fortunate over the last 30 years to build a very extensive network of people, extraordinary people, who offer a range of skills. So I am sort of thinking that we could perhaps bring opportunities to them. For example, in Japan at the moment, inbound tourism is booming, especially as we sort of approach Olympics here. And so there are many businesses and sort of local national tourism organisations looking to sort of promote themselves too. But, well, in English, most of our contributors tend to be bilingual in one or another language. And on top of that, yes, we hope to sort of... We know that the appeal of Kyoto as a city, as a place to visit, and Japan at large, we ought to quite capitalise on that. So we are hoping to have a sort of publishing arm and continue making Kyoto-specific or Japan-specific material.
Listen to Cowing there talking to Henry. Kyoto Journal number 89 is out now. You can find out more at kyotojournal.org. And Kathy's still with me listening to that. What a nice story to see something that's gone digital, but then sort of realise the power of print. We're talking about the power of print to, well, kids that could probably barely even pick up a magazine. But the power of print endures. And so wonderful to see a very, very beautiful title back on the printed page again.
Yeah, absolutely amazing looking. And I can't imagine how great looking it could have been, or what a great experience it could have been online. I think it's absolutely right that it should have gone back as a print product, because it just looks really great and is something that you just want to have a look at and read and lose yourself in, which I don't think you can do that online.
Tell me a bit more about the future. Have you got dot in Spanish, mm-hmm. imminently, presumably other new projects. Do you have any, your eye, even that, the eyes of a child, trained on anything else in the middle distance? Or you sound like you've got enough on your plate for now.
I think I've got enough on my plate. There are a few projects coming up, which obviously I can't talk about, but .Spanish is really the main focus. And obviously it is going to be a .English edition coming out in the spring as well as an Anorak spring. I took a holiday for the first time in 3 years in December, and I'm in a little bit of a reflective state at the moment, which is actually really good. So I'm thinking about the long term and, you know, the next step with something like this, where I've built up this brand mini empire. What do I do with it next? And how can it work across all other things? Mm-hmm. And I'm just looking at, you know, I'm just meeting lots of business people, entrepreneurs who talk about business plan and strategy and things like that. And it's a really, really interesting step. It's something that obviously doesn't come as natural as writing a story for Dot and the Boat, but it's still something that I'm massively interested in, and I can't wait to see what happens next.
Wow, what circularity. We started by talking about business plans. We came back to them at the end. That's probably a first on the stack. You mark my words. Well, look, good luck with the next steps.
Thank you.
We can't wait to see the other projects. So do keep in touch and bring them back to see us, certainly with your new issues later in the spring.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week's programme. My thanks to our producers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rhys Sheridan, and to our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are welcome. As always, drop a line to Fernando. You'll find him on fp@monocle.com. Don't forget to join us at the same time next week. You can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes or Spotify or your favoured podcast platform. There is still time to pick up tickets for the Monocle Media Summit. It's happening on Monday here in London. Head to the website for more about that. But if you can't join us in person, do be sure to tune into The Stack at the same time next week. It'll be a special from the event. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.